for argument is BPI versus JEC, Mr. Robinson.
So much for the audience. So much for our audience.
Is that the whole ACLU of Chicago? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, please, the court. BPI's claims are a promissory estoppel and the fraud and the inducement are based upon promises made in a memorandum of understanding and a letter of intent.
Well, the memorandum of understanding is very explicit. It's not binding. It's not final and so on. And so, I don't know. It seems to be a pretty thin basis for charging fraud.
Your Honor, the memorandum of understanding is but the first of the two written agreements. The letter of intent, the last sentence, states, and I quote, both parties agree to complete due diligence as quickly as possible and to work on final agreements that will specifically define the responsibilities and commitments related to the matters addressed herein. And that the matters addressed herein was the strategic alliance that BPI and the Drummond companies, I'll call them, agreed in concept to. Shortly after the letter of intent was executed and within the standstill period, the Drummond companies made sure that they obtained the coal rights, and based on the evidence in the record, the CEO of the company, Gary Drummond, had no intent from the beginning to ever honor those. He testified in his deposition in this case.
The letter of intent says, the letter of intent is intended to form the basis and outline for negotiations of final agreements. Parties acknowledge that this letter of intent does not constitute a binding agreement upon the parties except with respect to the agreement to maintain confidentiality and the standstill provisions. A binding commitment will result only from execution of definitive agreements. Why doesn't that leave open the fact that there may never be a deal?
Well, obviously the trial court, the district court, thought that that was an important factor, and it cited integration clauses in this very agreement and in other agreements between the parties, as well as that non-binding effect that you're talking about. But that contradicts both of those reasonings, or support, if you will, for the district court decision, contradicts the Vigertoni case that was decided in 2002, I think, by this court, which specifically says that integration clauses do not affect or bar fraud claims. And in terms of the non-binding effect, I would suggest that the district court's citation of this court's AMPAT decision from 1990 illustrates that not every case where oral representations or even in the context of a non-binding letter of intent, where there couldn't be fraud. The AMPAT decision by this court suggests that a party to a contract is not required to assume that the other party to the contract is a liar. And I would suggest to the court today that the evidence in this case, taken as a whole and considered in the light most favorable to BPI, the non-moving party at summary judgment stage.
I mean you're right about Vigertone, but the problem is that if fraud is interpreted broadly, then the parole evidence rule goes out the window and breach of contract suits become recharacterized as fraud suits. That's the problem.
Well,
anyone can testify, oh, well, you know, they promised, They say some oral promise. They didn't mean it. They mean to keep it.
Your Honor, the response to that is that what I believe is the quote that I read to you from the letter of intent at the very beginning, which is both parties agree to complete due diligence as quickly as possible and to work on final agreements. According to the testimony of the Drummond CEO, Mr. Gary Drummond, he had no intent of doing that. He never did that. That's the spice and the substance of promissory fraud or fraud in the inducement. And it requires a scheme. It requires prior intent, deliberate kind of intent or deliberate plan or scheme. And that's what we believe the evidence said. In this case, the district court did not mention anywhere in its order.
But is it reasonable to rely on a letter of intent and incur substantial expenses? Is that your proposition, that your client relied on what was in this letter of intent and the memorandum of understanding and, you know, changed its position irrevocably? Is that the argument?
Definitely is our position, Your Honor, that BPI was justified in relying on these promises, especially after the Drummond companies rushed in soon after this LOI was signed, made sure that they got the coal rights, and then delayed, ultimately giving a coal bed methane lease, a CBM lease, to BPI, but immediately repudiated it.
If that's correct, Mr. Robinson, how could anybody enter into negotiations under a non-binding letter of intent without risking years of litigation?
Well, as this court said in the AMPAT case...
Is that in your briefs?
Pardon?
Is the AMPAT case in your briefs?
It's in the not only the briefs, Your Honor, I think it's also cited by the district court in support of...
I'm looking at your table of authorities.
I'm not sure
at
this point.
What am I missing?
But it's been argued, and it certainly was mentioned by the trial court. And it was mentioned by the trial court on the subject of whether BPI's reliance was justified or not. And that's the AMPAT case contains the quote that I just mentioned.
But
that
following up on Judge Hamilton's question, so you see, on the strength of the letter of intent, BPI transferred these coal leases?
BPI, on the strength of the promises made and believing in good faith that Drummond was in good faith and not knowing anything about Gary Drummond.
No, but you're saying that it was in reliance on the letter of intent, the memorandum of understanding, that it transferred these leases and, to its detriment, changed its position. Was that reasonable? Shouldn't it have waited for a contract before it transferred anything?
Well, again, as I believe the court analyzed in the AMPAT decision in 1990, there are degrees of risk. Now, the trial court here, the district court, found that this was a manifest danger to for BPI to assume that they could safely transfer the coal rights in light of the fact that there was a non-binding aspect of it. This court decided, actually, 2 months ago on July the 20th in a case called Trevari versus Simpkins, a case that we supplemented our brief. This was decided after the briefs were closed in this case, but that case was a contract case, but nevertheless, the court basically found that
That's a very big difference, right? I mean, if you have a contract, sure, that's fine. But if you just have a letter of intent can be a contract and can include enforceable provisions. But this one, you know, was explicitly non-binding. And to rely on a non-binding letter or memo...
Your Honor, that's precisely what the facts were in the Trevari case.
No, there's a binding provision in the letter of intent in Trevari. Binding provision. This is non-binding. That's a very important difference.
Well, I would submit to you that that the parties bound themselves in the letter of intent in this case.
No, how can you bind yourself in a letter of intent when the letter of intent says it's not a binding agreement?
The same way you could do it in the Trovari case. The court implied good faith.
Look, you can have letters of intent that are enforceable. But if the letter of intent says this is not a binding agreement, it's not a binding agreement.
But it has binding aspects.
It doesn't have binding aspects. How does a binding agreement have binding? How does a non-binding agreement have binding aspects?
The so-called non-binding.
I don't know why you say so-called. It says non-binding. It's your letter of intent.
For the same reason that this court decided in the Trovari case on July the 20th that a mostly non-binding
entirely non-binding, this agreement.
This is not entirely non-binding whatsoever. It's binding for 60 days. It has a binding confidentiality agreement, and I submit to the court.
Yes, it has a binding. Look, what it says is does not constitute a binding agreement except with respect to the agreement to maintain confidentiality and the standstill provisions. It's not binding about anything to do with transferring your leases.
What about the implied covenant of good faith that was discussed in Trovari? What about the last sentence?
Well, you're going to use implied good faith to turn every letter of intent into a binding contract? What's the purpose? What's the point of saying it's not binding? You're going to pull a... an implied duty of good faith out of the air.
The fact is that if you have evidence of fraud and a scheme to defraud, as we have in this case, through the testimony of Mr. Gary Drummond and the Lane Energy documents that were discovered later, none of which was known to BPI.
Why is that evidence of fraud?
Pardon?
Why is that evidence of fraud?
The Lane documents?
That one passage of testimony of Gary Drummond.
Well, Gary Drummond's testimony taken as a whole, Your Honor, indicates that he was treating the BPI document the same way that they had treated the Lane Energy documents weeks and months before. When the beginning of the transaction between BPI and Drummond began in September of 2004, Your Honor, Drummond Company was still negotiating with and talking to the Lane Energy people about the same CBM leases. And they said, oh, by the way, we're pulling out of that, Lane Energy, because maybe you haven't read this, but the agreement that we signed with you last year was non-binding, even though we continue to negotiate. It's the same as the Trovari case on July the 20th.
Not. So Drummond, I thought the evidence was Drummond discovered afterwards, after the leases were transferred, that his subordinate had set too low a royalty rate. So he says, I'm not going to go through with this.
That was his part of his testimony.
Why is that fraudulent? It's a non-binding agreement. He hoped to work something out. Your client jumped the gun and transfers the leases. And then the other party discovers that it doesn't want to go through with this because the royalty rate is too low. I don't think it's even a breach of contract. Where's the fraud?
The fraud is in the fact that under Illinois law, if there is a proof, there's some evidence, as there is here, of a scheme, of a premeditated plan.
Well, when you say premeditated scheme, are you saying that before the letter of intent was signed and before the leases were transferred, Drummond had no intention of having any kind of deal with your client?
Yes, based on...
What would be the purpose of that? Well, what would he get from that?
For the same purpose that the Lane Energy documents preceded the documents in this case.
Well, what would he have achieved by that? I don't understand.
He would hold out the carrot, if you will, of a strategic alliance agreement in order to get BPI to transfer coal rights.
Why would he think that BPI would transfer these leases before it was contractually obligated to do so?
Why would he think that?
Yeah.
Because he had made promises in the letter of intent and earlier in the MOU.
Going back to the letter of intent, he didn't make an enforceable promise in the letter of intent. It's just a letter of intent. It's non-binding. Why would he think that BPI, not being obligated to do anything except to abide by the confidentiality agreement, would give him the leases?
Because I believe that under Illinois law, a party to a contract, as is indicated in the Trevari opinion from a couple months ago, is entitled to believe that the other party is in good faith. The AMPAT case says that very thing. We are at the summary judgment stage, Your Honor, and in closing, I would just suggest that all we're asking is for an opportunity to have the evidence heard. Our position is that the district court simply failed to consider all the evidence and give it meaning and a view most favorable to BPI. We are also saying that the district court in its order plainly didn't even mention the Drummond testimony, didn't mention the Lane documents that were there, and didn't make any inferences or did not make all the inferences in favor of BPI as it should at the summary judgment stage.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Elliott?
Your Honors, Paul Elliott and I represent the appellees. Let's go first to that memorandum of understanding. You're right. Not only is it non-binding, but it had expired by its own terms. In fact, the parties expressly terminated the MOU on the same day that they executed the letter of intent agreement, and that's in the record on docket 238, page 3.
Well, that letter of intent is also non-binding and not actionable in contract.
Correct. There's an aspect to it. There's a standstill agreement for 60 days, which is binding, and there's a confidentiality agreement in the letter of intent, which is binding. That letter of intent, however, expired after 60 days, although in this case the parties actually extended the letter of intent, and that's in the record on November 23, 2004. They extended the standstill portion of the letter of intent until December 15, 2004, and that's in the record at docket 238, page 5. But that means as of December 15, 2004, that letter of intent was expired, including the standstill provision. So clearly, BPI could no longer rely on the notion that there was some sort of binding obligation, whether under the MOU, which was expired and terminated, or the LOI, which was expired as of December 15, 2004. Now, BPI in this case, when it was first filed, they alleged 8 claims against the defendants.
So the leases were transferred after that?
The leases were transferred within the standstill period of a letter of intent. So BPI, they're called the county coal transactions, and I apologize, they're not leases. They're actually interest in coal, and they're right. Warranty deeds. So the counties, the rights to the Shelby County coal, the Clinton County coal, and Christian County coals were transferred in October and November of 2004. After that point, there were no more further transactions within the standstill period of the letter of intent. Now, originally, BPI did allege that the defendants had breached the MOU, that defendants had breached the LOI, that defendants had breached the strategic alliance agreement, as they call it, and even that the defendants breached the coal leases, which they eventually executed in April of 2006. But in response to defense motions, they dropped all these breach of contract claims because they couldn't prove that my clients breached any of those contracts. And they dropped the very breach of contract claim on the leases, which they claim were the very agreements which fraudulently induced and that for defendants to execute, and that defendants had no intention of honoring those leases. Well, defendants have honored those leases. All they did was believe that BPI was in default of those leases, and they exercised their contractual right and legal rights to have a declaratory judgment action heard by the district court in Illinois to determine that, in fact, BPI was in default and that the leases were terminated. And they made very clear to the district court, if, in fact, the leases are not terminated, if, in fact, BPI is not in default, we're going to honor those leases. Now,
what's the status of that litigation?
I'm sorry?
You said there's separate litigation on the issue of breach of the leases?
No. The defendants originally filed a claim in Alabama District Court to have the leases declared terminated. And then after BPI sued us in Illinois, we filed it as a counterclaim. And BPI originally did sue us, claiming that we had breached the CBM leases.
Right, right.
And one of their claims was that we failed to provide mine maps. And the fact of the matter is there's no obligation to provide mine maps if you don't have a mine that you're planning to open anytime soon. So they dropped that claim. And so all that's left is a claim of fraud and fraudulent inducement. And there's simply no evidence of fraud under this, under just common law principles. And more importantly, what's missing here is any discussion of the statute of frauds. It's one thing to say that parole evidence might make evidence of a parole agreement admissible. Here you have the statute of fraud and the very promise, the parole promise that they want to have used in evidence and to be bound against us is one that violates the statute of frauds. And the Illinois courts are very clear, and the statute is clear, that you cannot supply by parole evidence an agreement which is subject to the statute of frauds.
That's a contract defense.
I'm sorry?
That's a contract defense.
It's
not a tort defense.
The statute of frauds.
I'm sorry?
The statute of frauds is a contract defense, so to the extent that there's any contract claims still kicking around in this case, it would apply to bar those claims. But this really reduces to fraud claims for damages and fraud in the inducement claims
correct,
rescission and restitution.
But if
and
we're
those
going,
are, I mean, the latter is probably a contract claim, but it's equitable in nature. The former is a tort claim.
Okay.
The statute of frauds only bars contract claims.
But if we're going to an issue of whether or not somebody is reasonably relying upon a promise to transfer a 20-year lease and a mineral interest in coal bed methane, that cannot be reasonable when the requirements of the statute of frauds.
That's a different question.
Okay.
But statute of frauds drops out once the contract claims.
Okay. Well, we also believe, Your Honor, that the parole evidence is not admissible and that reliance is not reasonable under these circumstances and not justifiable.
Your whole parole evidence argument doesn't apply to a tort claim. It applies to a contract claim.
I understand that. I apologize.
The fraud and the inducement claim may be a contract claim, so you may have an argument there. But
correct. And that's. I apologize. I'm not making it clear. Clearly, it is important that the court take into context the fact that these agreements and all of the subsequent agreements, the coal transfer agreements, all had integration clauses.
That's also a contract defense.
I understand, but the notion is that what we're trying to figure out whether or not there was it reasonable for BPI to believe that there was a binding agreement on my clients to give them a coal bed methane lease. And there is not justifiable reliance because the parties executed agreements, definitive agreements, which did not contain that contractual obligation on the part of my clients. So we don't believe that somebody can justifiably claim that they justifiably did something due to a parole agreement when the written contracts that the parties executed contained integration clauses and described the consideration to be paid for those agreements and excluded any notion that there was an obligation to deliver a CBM lease.
I've lost the thread now. So we were talking about the MOU, the LOI, but this transfer of leases or whatever was transferred, interests in coal, that presumably is a separate contract.
Correct. Those are executed in April of 2006. And your
position is that there was a breach of those contracts.
Correct.
And so you canceled them and you recovered the interests.
We believe that those agreements, those CBM leases, are binding. They're binding obligations. They're binding on my client, despite the mistake that they made in not realizing that there was a below market royalty rate in there. We also believe that it's binding on BPI. And we discovered evidence that BPI was not complying with the contract. And at the time, they were suffering a lot of financial difficulty. And the easiest way for our clients to determine that was that there was a requirement that BPI obtain insurance, listing our clients as additional insureds, in which case we would have received a policy. We never received it. We sent them a notice of default. And in response to that notice of default, BPI provided no evidence that they cured and no evidence that they were performing under the leases. That's why we filed a declaratory judgment action.
I'm still unclear on the status of this request for declaratory judgment that your client is not in breach of the leases, that your client properly terminated them for default?
Yes.
That is a claim that remains alive in this case?
I apologize. Now I know what you're talking about. It is gone from the case. Okay. They admitted they've given us the leases back as part of a stipulation. The BPI never answered our counterclaim on that point, and we agreed to, if they would give us the leases, that we would agree to a dismissal so that they could appeal this case.
It's been dismissed with prejudice.
It has been dismissed.
Problem.
Pursuant to the agreement, yes.
Okay.
Pursuant to the party's agreement and stipulation of dismissal. A couple of things I want to do. One housekeeping matter. We talk about Gary Drummond, and he's the CEO. Mr. Drummond is the CEO of Drummond Company, Inc. He's not. Drummond Company, Inc. is not a party to any of these agreements. It's not a party to any of these coal company LLCs that were formed. And there's no allegation or proof that there's an alter ego issue here or a piercing of corporate veil here. So when we're talking about fraud, it's important, like in any fraud case, to say, who committed the fraud? What did they say? When did they say it? And was it reasonable for somebody to rely on that? And they always want to try to gloss over that. So when you look actually to what could have possibly been the fraud, could Mr. Drummond have committed a fraud and fraudulently induced BPI? No. Mr. Aslan, the CEO of BPI, admitted that nobody at a BPI had talked to Mr. Drummond before any of these documents were executed. The coal leases were already in dispute by the time they ever talked to Mr. Drummond. Would Mr. Webster, the president of IEC who signed the CBM leases, could he have committed the fraud? No. Again, Mr. Aslan admitted nobody at BPI talked to Mr. Webster, the person who actually signed, in fact, all these agreements with BPI. So there's nobody that they could point to that induced them and that they could have justifiably relied upon as entering into these agreements. The one person they did interact with was Kim Burke. Kim Burke was the employee who toward the end of negotiations agreed to a below-market rate. And he didn't tell Mr. Webster about it, and he didn't tell Mr. Drummond about it. But either way, Mr. Aslan testified that he knew and understood that Mr. Burke had no authority to bind or sign any documents on behalf of Drummond or any of the other defendants. So how can you reasonably rely upon somebody if you recognize that they have no authority to bind any of the defendants? And that's on page docket 238, exhibit 53 from his deposition, page 182, line 4. Quote, Kim Burke did not have the authority to sign any document on behalf of Drummond or any of these entities as the structure of the strategic alliance had been laid out.
BPI suggests that this prior course of conduct with Lane is evidence of fraud in the inducement in this case, because it demonstrates that your client was engaged in a course of conduct to get coal rights by fraud.
Right.
And that scheme was brought to fruition in this case. Can you address whether that evidence kind of withstands that interpretation?
The evidence with Lane shows that it's a letter of intent. It has a 90-day standstill period. That letter of intent executed on June 25th of 2003. It expired in September 2003. And the parties may have continued to negotiate. Whether they did or not is irrelevant. There's not any fraud in the fact that you tried to negotiate with Lane. You couldn't reach an agreement with them. They then went to BPI, executed the MOU. Lane wrote a letter saying, hey, are you interested in negotiating? We said, no, we're actually got something else going on, and your letter of intent expired, so we have no obligation to negotiate exclusively with you. That's not fraud. That's just somebody simply trying to negotiate a mutually acceptable agreement. So there's no fraud when the scheme doesn't work because there's no scheme with respect to Lane. The scheme exception doesn't work because there's nothing that Mr. Drummond did that had any communications whatsoever with any of the people at BPI.
Without that and without this Drummond testimony, is there anything else to support a fraud in the inducement claim that your client never intended to honor the leases?
That's why
that's all I see, but I don't know.
Well, that's why I've been frustrated, frankly, with the fact when they use the word Drummond and Drummond affiliates with no intent to honor. What did they say that induced you to sign it, that caused you to do that? If it's the LOI and MOU, that can't work. And then the notion of fraud, if it is a fraudulent statement, it has to be something that's been done and proven by clear and convincing evidence, and there is no clear and convincing evidence of the fraud. At best, what they said is Mr. Burke promised to enter into a favorable CBM lease at some point in the future.
That was done.
It was done, correct. Exactly. And they got what they wanted. And, in fact, under this partial performance exception to the statute of frauds, where BPI says claims that it performs, that gives you a specific performance remedy, not a rescission remedy. What BPI wants to do, they don't want the leases. The CBM leases, they've gone into bankruptcy. They're out of business.
They want the coal option.
They want
back.
The coal to see if they can't flip that over to somebody else and make some
right.
money on it.
Right.
So that's the only reason that they want the coal back, is because the CBM leases are worthless. Do you have any other questions, Your Honor?
No. Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Mr. Robinson?
Most fraud cases are proven by circumstantial evidence, and here we have testimony from Mr. Drummond, who, in spite of what opposing counsel says, is the head of the Drummond family. The appellees in this case are a bunch of LLCs who were set up at the request of Mr. Drummond, Mr. Webster. The evidence is replete on that. He is the person who directed the LLCs. He directs his families. His family, children and grandchildren, own these LLCs that received the coal rights. All we are asking, Your Honors, is for the right to have the decks cleared
and
the evidence presented.
What is your evidence that Drummond... never intended to honor the leases? Is that
that is exactly correct? And the
what's your best evidence of that? Or
the best
allegation?
It's a compendium of things. It's probably the best evidence is Mr. Drummond's own testimony, that he was mad when he heard that these leases were given, finally, to BPI. And the circumstantial evidence would be the Lane documents, which, as counsel just admitted, they were still talking to Lane about these very CBM leases when they entered into the first MOU with BPI. Then they confirmed, well, you know, we're done with you. We're going to someone else. And it was because Lane Energy, and this is in the record, basically discovered, I think, and the documents that were under seal that are now not, show that, this correspondence back and forth between Lane Energy. But beyond that, the circumstantial evidence shows that when Drummond was forced to give up CBM leases to BPI, because they wanted more coal. They had this insatiable desire to have coal. And I would submit to you that the point that counsel made about extending the LOI until November suggests even more that they wanted to use that document, that LOI, to induce BPI to give up the coal rights, never intending to give them the CBM rights. Remember, the evidence also indicates that from the beginning of the delivery of the coal bed methane leases, Drummond was trying to get them back. They first claimed that Mr. Webster...
You agreed to the termination of those leases, right?
In the litigation,
yeah.
We did so that we could get to this appeal. That's correct.
Okay. If you agreed to the termination of those leases, why is there anything left of this?
We didn't agree to the termination. We agreed to terminate the litigation about the leases.
And
I mean, the fact of it is that Drummond should not be allowed to take advantage and have the advantage of the fraud that we believe the evidence shows. We believe that we ought to be permitted, or that the client should be permitted to have a hearing. And that's at this stage, it appears that based on the lower court's order, Drummond's testimony was not considered. The Lane documents were not considered. The lower court based its whole opinion in that regard on this non-binding effect. And I would urge the court to look again at the Trovari case, because there are some, even though it's a contract case and this is a fraud case, there are similarities because of the LOI and the bad faith. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson.